I wanted today to read. I think that while we were separated, my wife, at least, who is my chief analyst, analyzed that I got louder and longer in being in a sanctuary by myself. And she did not, I will say in her defense, so that I don't get in trouble, she did not say that as a criticism. It was just an observation. And I don't know how being here will affect me, but we did get somewhat more lengthy, especially in the Pilgrim's Progress. And I just trying to cover ground. But I don't seem to be getting very far very fast with the reading of the second part, because there's so much wonderful material from other sources besides Mr. Bunyan himself. And I have wanted to give those to you. In fact, I mentioned it a couple of times recently to you in the recordings that I was taking the time to do some reading for you so that we may take advantage of our time together, and you might get access to hear some things that maybe you don't have the time in your life to read. And so I want to be sure some of these things you get. So this morning, before I go into the reading at all, actually, I want to back up just a little bit, do a summary. I think that's what I put in your bulletin, that do a summary of where we've come this far, and I wanted to do it with actually in the words of Alexander White. And I think most of you by now have these books, just because you have them. As I say, I don't assume that you are reading them or that you have to. I'm just saying I want you specifically to hear what Alexander White has to say. And I'm picking up the reading of his summary on Christiana from page 266 in his book on Pilgrim's Progress Part 2. Pick up the reading there, and he says, "And now I shall sum up my chief impressions of Christiana under the three heads of her mind, her heart, and her widowhood." These are so significant. The way White expresses these thoughts are significant enough that I felt they are worthy of our hearing. Number one, under the head of her mind, he says the mother of Christian's four sons was a woman of real mind, as so many of the maidens and wives and widows of Puritan England and Covenanting Scotland were. Those women were women of the mind. You gradually gather, says White, the impression just from being beside her in the journey as she goes on. She does not speak much. But then there is always something individual, something remarkable and memorable in what she says. I have a notion of my own, now this is White speaking, not Bunyan. I have a notion of my own that Christiana must have been a reader of that princely Puritan, John Milton. And if that was so, that of itself would be certificate enough as to her possession of mind. There is always dignity and strength about her utterances. I don't think, my view personally, I don't think a more grand word could be said of a woman than that. There was always dignity and strength in her utterances that make us feel sure that she had always had a mind far above her neighbors. Mrs. Bat's Eyes, Mrs. Light Mind, and Mrs. Know Nothing. The first time she opens her mouth, which is, by the way, in the version that we're using, this white book of Pilgrim's Progress, this what he's referring to, just in case you want the reference, is on the top of page 353, the first time that Christiana speaks. He says, the first time she opens her mouth, in our hearing, she lets fall an expression that Milton had just made famous in his work called Samson. Now, understand, White's taking a little license here. Christiana, in Bunyan's writing, didn't actually quote this. But what White is saying is she said essentially this. And he's referring to it. This is a quote of John Milton in Samson. He said, ease to the body some, none to the mind, from restless thoughts that like a deadly swarm of hornets armed no sooner found alone, but rush upon the thronging and present times past, what once I was and what am now. He's expressing the fact of unrest, this quietude of heart. And the first time Christiana speaks, that's what we see. That's what she relates. Nor can I leave this point, says White, without asserting it to you that no church and no school of theology has ever developed the mind as well as sanctified the heart of common people like the preaching of the Puritan pulpit. I think most our men would render an amen to that. Matthew Arnold, who, by the way, was a professor of poetry at Oxford. He was a sick, secular English teacher from 1822 to 1888. Matthew Arnold was not likely to overestimate the good that Puritanism had done to England. Indeed, in his early writings, he sometimes went out of his way to lament the hurt that the Puritan spirit had done to the liberality of life and mind in his native land. In other words, he was no friend to Puritanism in his early days. But in his riper years, we find him saying, quote, certainly I am not blind to the faults of the Puritan discipline, but it has been an invaluable discipline for that poor, inattentive, and immoral creature, man. And the more I read history and the more I see of mankind, the more I recognize the value of the Puritan discipline. And this coming from a secular professor of poetry. In the same address, he said he had found his best hopes for that in enviable and unbounded country in which he was speaking, America, on the fact that so many of its millions have passed through this Puritan discipline. Wow. He's describing America of the day. And he said, my fondest hope for that country is that so many of its people have passed through this Puritan discipline. Quite a compliment. John Milton was a product of that discipline on the one hand, and John Bunyan was on the other. Christiana was another of its products in the sphere of the family, just as Matthew Arnold himself had some of his best qualities out of that same fruitful school, Puritanism. So he addresses her mind. Then number two, he addresses Christiana in a summary way. He says her heart, her deep, strong, tender heart, is present on every page of Christiana's noble history. Her heart keeps her often silent when the water in her eyes becomes the more eloquent. Sometimes we speak the loudest when we speak not at all. Isn't that true? Especially when the tears are flowing. Her heart keeps her often silent when the water in her eyes becomes all the more eloquent. When she does let her heart utter itself in words, her words are fine and memorable. As for one instance, after Great Heart's discourse on redemption, she says, "O mercy that thy father and mother were here, yea, and Miss Timorous also. Nay, I wish with all my heart now that here was Madam Wanton too. Surely, surely their hearts would be affected, nor could the fear of one nor the powerful lust of the other prevail with them to go home again and refuse to become good pilgrims." But it was not so much what she said herself that brought out of depths the tenderness of Christiana's heart. It was rather the way her heart loosened other people's tongues. "You must all have felt," now this is White writing to us, "you must all have felt how some people's presence straightens your heart and sews up your mouth." Amen. That's a powerful woman when her presence straightens your heart and sews up your mouth. While there are other people, again, whose simple presence unseals your heart and makes you eloquent. We ministers keenly feel that both in our public and in our private ministrations, we keenly feel that. There are people in whose hard and chilling presence we cannot even say grace as we should say it. Whereas we all know other people, people of the heart, that is, whose presence somewhat so touches our lips that we always, when we're near them, we rise far above ourselves. So he's addressing her heart. And then thirdly, "And then a widow indeed," he calls her a widow indeed, "is just a true and genuine widow. A widow not in her name and in her deeds only, but still more in her deep heart, in the whole life, and in her garnered experience. She was," he says, "a widow indeed," and goes on and talks about her sorrow. Her sorrow, he says, "is a crown of honor and a scepter of authority to her. She's consulted by the young and the inexperienced, by the forsaken and the forlorn, as no other human being ever is. She has come through this life, and by long experience she knows this world and the hearts that fill it and make it what it is." That's what kind of woman she is. She has this experience. She knows the human heart, and to be in her presence is to realize that. A widow indeed can show a sympathy and give a counsel and speak with a weight of wisdom that one's own mother cannot always do. "All you who by God's sad dispensations are now clothed in the white and wimpled folds of widowhood, let your prayer and your endeavor day and night be that God would guide and enable you to be widows indeed. And if you do, you shall want neither your occupation nor your honor." Pretty good analysis. Pretty good analysis of Christiana. Anybody have any comment or anything you want to say about that? That reading? If not, I had another thing I wanted to read you. Something of a review. Overton, these lectures, these cottage lectures by Overton, I find just absolutely wonderful, just tremendous. Of course, they were given as sermons originally, but Overton, let me share with you something Overton says. Under a title, a chapter title, A Whole Family on Pilgrimage. And he quotes Psalm 119, verse 60. I made haste and delayed. I made haste and delayed not to keep thy commandments. Overton says, when good desires, and of course, Christiana, he's referring to the fact that Christiana had this desire after the death of Christian, her husband. She had this desire to go on pilgrimage, and she didn't delay. She didn't dally. She did it immediately. When good desires are put into our hearts, we should seek immediately to bring that to good effect. We have an expression, don't we? Strike while the iron is hot. Strike while the iron is hot. When good desires are put in our hearts, we should seek immediately to bring them to good effect. No delays are so dangerous as those which elapse between the formation and the fulfillment of some gracious resolution. In the verse that we just read, and I read to you, I made haste and delayed not to keep thy commandments. David had described the blessed effects of serious consideration. He said, I thought on my ways and turned my feet unto thy testimonies. And then as if on purpose to instruct us that prompt obedience will surely mark the implantation of a gracious principle, he tells us, I made haste and did not delay. Christiana acted in the same manner. Her resolution was considered in our last lecture. Her manner in which she acted upon it is to be our present consideration. First of all, he says, see the temptation which she resisted. Just as she was preparing to set out with her children, two neighbors knocked at the door. In language of piety to which she had hitherto been a stranger, she begged them to come in. And she disclosed to them her heart. Here she is. She just has made purpose to set out in this journey. And a knock comes at the door. So immediately she has to overcome difficulty. With the happy ingenuity peculiar to those who are really in earnest, she was enabled to derive encouragement from the very argument which was used to discourage her. Remember that? They said, you don't want to do that. Man, trouble. There's so much trouble. You remember your husband, all the trouble he had. You don't want to do this. It's just so much trouble. And she turns that, and rather than being a discouragement, that forms an encouragement for her. That she is, in fact, in the right way and doing the right thing. Very soon, she turned from such a gloomy piece of business to converse about those vain delights, that is, timorous, and her friends turned very quickly away from that conversation. The great adversary will always endeavor to smother your convictions. That's a good expression. Smother your convictions and to turn you from a settled purpose of heart. You have resolved firmly to cast in your lot with the true pilgrim, true disciples of Christ. You've purposed to forsake all your vain and foolish ways, to pray in your family, to hallow the Sabbath, to celebrate the Lord's Supper, and in short, to lead a godly and Christian life. But lo, some of your unconverted and worldly friends or family come to see you. Yes, and when they come to see you, they talk vainly. They are greatly surprised at your determination. They think you're losing your senses. They try first to see what ridicule will do. And if you will not be laughed out of your resolution, they'll try the force of fear and discouragement. Isn't that right? They will give you such a gloomy picture of the sorrows and hardships and trials of a religious life as to make you out of love with it if they can. If you're still unmovable, they will probably load you with reproach and contempt. And that's the last stage. They'll start out laughing at you, ridicule. And if you don't become discouraged by the laughter, being made a fool out of, they think, then they'll turn to hardships and try to create fear. And if that doesn't work, as a last ditch effort, they'll try to load you with reproach, contempt, just downright hatred. Just hate you. And then they'll go and join with lovers of pleasure and vain and thoughtless, light-hearted people who never look beyond the present hour and think nothing of what must become of their never-dying souls. Eventually, they'll just dump you. He says in another place, the way to Zion is always narrow, and generally, at the beginning, it's rough and thorny. But mercy said, come, we must venture, only let us be wary. Then they all looked well to their steps, and after some difficulties and many escapes, the whole party got safely over. By the way, I did emphasize it, I think, last week, but I do want to mention it again. Isn't it interesting that it's mercy who encourages Christiana to keep going? And yet, once they get across this slough of despond, this discouragement, in that place, mercy reveals her heart and that she still has no peace at all, that she's even going to be accepted. Isn't it interesting that the one who has the least peace has the most function in bringing encouragement and stability to the other? That's an amazing thing. Well, in other places, he says, talking about Christiana inviting Mercy and encouraging her to go with her, even though she doesn't have a letter from the king specifically, she didn't get a visit specifically from the preacher, she encourages her to go. She says, you are invited, freely invited. You are. Indeed, you are. So she says, go, come and go with me. And then Overton says, the special invitation is sometimes sent in the whirlwind and the storm, but it's more frequently delivered by the still small voice that worships in the heart. 1 Kings 19:12 is the reference there. And I just want to make a comment to you, to all of you, especially children growing up in Christian homes. He says that special invitation which Christiana got, which was very powerful, very huge impact. Okay, she got a visit, special visitor came who had a letter, and there was this conversation, and wow, Mercy didn't get any of that. And there's the danger of us thinking that the only folks who really are saved are those who've had some huge, phenomenal experience like that. But I said it, I think, last week, recently, but I do want to say it again. Mercy was well and truly on the road to Zion. Just as surely on the road to Zion as was Christiana. Notwithstanding the difference in their experience, notwithstanding that Christiana had had this great letter and this great visitation and all that, and Mercy had had none of that, notwithstanding that difference, when they set out on this road to Zion, Mercy was well and truly in the path and going to Zion, just as surely as was Christiana. And that's important for us to note and remember, especially for children that grow up in a Christian home. They may not have some huge phenomenal experience, some visitation from an agent from God knocks at the door. They may not have those experiences. But if they have, like Mercy, purposed to go with Christiana to this city, they are as well and truly in the way as any saint ever has been. The special revelation, says Overton, the special invitation is sometimes sent in the whirlwind and the storm, but it is more frequently delivered in a still, small voice that whispers to the heart. Without any extraordinary terror, they begin humbly to hope for salvation in Christ. Isn't that good? Without any extraordinary terror, they simply begin to humbly hope for salvation in Christ. And then Overton says, oh, be encouraged to go forward. Be encouraged to go forward. Don't let the difference in your experience restrict your movement. Be encouraged and go forward. Mercy was just as well and truly on the way as was Christiana. So, just something of a kind of a review of and some oversight, overarching thoughts on this story up to where we are today. Is there any discussion of any of that? Anybody want to contribute something to that or make further comments? No? Well, it's an important subject, that's for sure. I fear that one of the dangers of children growing up in a Christian home is that it's not so, of course, in this church. We don't do these things. We don't practice that theology in this church. But in a lot of churches, one of the dangers, especially the churches that my wife and I came out of, one of the dangers for children growing up in a Christian home is that they are taught to expect those same whirlwind conversions. They are taught to expect the same experiences as some debauched drunkard that's been plucked out of years of debauchery. They're taught to expect that. And that if they don't experience that, then they have not experienced salvation. But that's a grave error and ought never be taught. It's a difference. Okay? Let me read just a bit here. Picking up, as Miss Julie rightly pointed out, page 368. Second paragraph says, this is Bunyan now speaking again. Then they went on again. And said Mercy to Christiana, had I as good ground to hope for a loving reception at the wicket gate as you, I think that no slough of despond could discourage me. As I said to you a minute ago, Mercy hasn't yet even any confidence that she's going, that she's going to be accepted. Sorry, she's committed to going, but she has no confidence that she's going to be accepted or be allowed in when she gets there. Well, said the other, you know your sore, and I know mine. And good friend, we shall all have enough evil before we come to our journey's end. For can it be imagined that the people who be designed to attain such excellent glories as we do, that are so envied that happiness as we are, but that we shall meet with what fears and snares, with what troubles and afflictions they can possibly assault us with that hate us. Mercy has expressed the turmoil in her soul over the fact that she doesn't have the confidence that Christiana has, or the grounds of confidence. And Christiana's response to her is very wise counsel and a good pattern to follow in such cases. She says to her, my dear friend, you know where your sorrows are, and I know where mine are. You have this burden, I have a different one. You are sore in this area, I'm sore in other areas. And besides that, as we carry on in this journey, you can be very sure we are both going to have plenty more trouble before this thing's over with. And so she's encouraging her, if I could kind of summarize the essence of her counsel, she's encouraging her not to become overly fixated, overly obsessed with this burden, with this soreness, but to realize that hers is in this area, somebody else's is in another area. We all have our struggles. We all have our soreness. We all have our battles. And we all are going to face even more down the road. She's encouraging her not to become fixated on this burden to hinder her from going. To hinder her from going forward. That's good counsel. It's a good note that Scott gives us in our book. He says, some persons are discouraged by recollecting past sins. By the way, that's the flip side of that coin. You know, if you here's a person who has a phenomenal conversion experience out of a life of terrible sin, and here's one who's reared in a Christian home and lived very, very righteously, at least externally. And if this one complains about that one, here's Mercy says, I'm burdened because I don't have the experience Christiana had. Christiana is burdened for what? Her past sins. How she had done her husband. That she was torn apart by the remembrance of her sin. So you see, these people who have these, can I just use the expression and you'll know what I mean? These people that have these phenomenal conversions out of terrible sin, they will carry with them for the rest of their lives the scars. They will carry the remembrance of that sin. And that will be to them an equal burden and soreness that this other is to the other person. Very wise. Scott says some persons are discouraged by recollecting sin, past sins, and imagining them too heinous to be forgiven, while others disquiet themselves by the apprehensions that they've never been truly humbled or converted. Indeed, all the varieties in the experience of those who upon the whole are walking in the same path, all of the varieties, he said, of their experience can never be enumerated. There's just too many. And some of them are not only unreasonable, but unaccountable. Through the weakness of human mind, the abiding effects of particular impressions, and the remains of unbelief, and the artifices of Satan. Now, he didn't number those, but in my book, I did. I wrote because there's four distinct things here, Scott names and says these can cause you to be struggling in your path to Zion. The weakness of your own mind, the abiding effects of particular impressions, the remains of unbelief, and the artifices of Satan. Any of these things, and they come in, what he's point he's making is that they come in so many varieties. They come in so many varieties, these four categories of problem, of thinking, that it's impossible to even enumerate them. They come in so many different varieties to discourage us from going forward. Bunyan, Chapman, quoting Bunyan in another place, says, "I tell you, sirs, you must not trust your own apprehensions nor judgments of the mercy of God." You must not trust your own apprehensions or judgments on the mercy of God. You do not know how He can cause it to abound. That which seems to be short and shrunk up to you, He can draw out and cause to abound exceedingly. There is a breadth and length and depth and height therein, that is, in the mercy of God, when God will please to open it, that for its infiniteness can swallow up not only all thy sins, but all thy thoughts and imaginations, and that also can drown thee at last. This, therefore, is a wonderful thing, and shall be wondered at to all eternity, that the river of mercy, that at first did seem to be ankle deep, shall so rise and rise that at the last it become waters to swim in and a river that could not be passed over. That's Ezekiel 47 verse 5. Ezekiel 47 verse 5. And I thought, what a tremendous title, what a tremendous theme for a sermon. Waters to swim in. Brother John referred to it in the prayer earlier for the meal. Drowning in an ocean of God. Waters to swim in that could not be passed over. That's the mercy of God. That's the mercy of God. What a thing. What a wonderful, blessed, glorious thing. Waters to swim in. So, soreness. One has one soreness and another has a different soreness. There's a wonderful, in English, in his commentary on Bunyan, on part two here, I'll give you this and we'll finish for today. English has a note about this slew of despond that Christiana and Mercy have come through just now, just finished. We just read that last time. He quotes Ralph Erskine, who, of course, was a Scottish churchman from 1685 to 1752. Ralph Erskine, in his lines on faith and frames compared, he gives a quote there out of a verse, a poem of Erskine. But I wanted to give you the poem. Listen to the whole poem. I looked it up and found it. Ralph Erskine wrote this. I don't know if it meant to be just a poem or him. It's in a book of poetry. He said, "Faith has its foundation broad, a stable rock on which I stand. The truth and faithfulness of God, all other grounds are sinking sand. My frames and feelings ebb and flow. And when my faith depends on them, it fleets and staggers to and fro and dies amidst the dying frame." Could I believe what God has spoke, rely on His unchanging love, and cease to grasp at fleeting smoke? No changes could my mountain move. When divine smiles in sight appear, and I enjoy the heavenly gale, when wind and tide and all is fair, I dream my faith shall never fail. But by sudden turns I see my lying heart's fallacious guilt, and that my faith, not firm in me, on sinking sand is partly built. So much my faith's affiance seems its life from fading joys to bring, that when I lose the dying streams, I cannot trust the living spring. Now there's a blessed picture. He says, when I lose the dying streams of God's presence, I cannot trust the living spring from which they flowed. What a thought. Lord, have mercy, help us. When drops of comfort quickly dried and sensible enjoyments fail, when cheering apples are denied, then doubts instead of faith prevail. But why, though fruit be snatched from me, should I distrust the glorious root and still affront the standing tree by trusting more to falling fruit? The frame of nature shall decay, time changes, break her rust. Time changes, break her rusty chains. Yea, heaven and earth shall pass away, but faith's foundation firm remains. Heaven's promises so fixed stand, engraved with an immortal pen, in great Emmanuel's mighty hand, all hell's attempts to raise are vain. Did faith with none but truth advise, my steady soul would move no more than stable hills when tempests rise or solid rocks when billows roar. But when my faith the counsel hears of present sense and reason blind, my wavering spirit then appears a feather tossed with every wind. I would, when dying comforts fly, as much as when they present were, upon thy living joy rely. Help, Lord, for here I daily err. Daily. Ralph Erskine, sometime in the mid-1700s, penned those words. English refers to just a verse or two out of it, but I went and found the whole poem because it describes how we are. We look for the streams, don't we? We look for the apples, for the fruit falling. And when the fruit ceases to fall, we start to doubt the roots of the tree. When the stream dries up, we forget about the spring. Inglis is saying that mercy, Christiana is trying to encourage mercy. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't get looking at that. Walk on. Just walk on. That's good counsel. That's good counsel. For every one of us, just walk on. Walk on. Be obedient. Any questions or comments? We'll stop there today. In that interview, could I use the word interview, between Christiana and her neighbors who had come to visit, she mounted no profound theological defense. Her whole influence, which turned one back to her sin and the other into the path, rested on her earnestness, rested on the sin. And doesn't that remind us of the young man who was interrogated time and time again after the Lord Jesus opened his eyes? He was interrogated time and time again. And he kept going back. He said, I don't know. I don't know any of this. I don't know what you're asking me. All I know is that I was blind, and now I see. I mean, talk about earnestness. That's all he had. That's all he had was that earnestness and that experience. And there's much to be said for the value of that. Just the earnestness of heart. And influencing people by it. One of the dangers, I think, for a believer, especially, say, a wife who's converted and husband isn't, or a husband is converted and wife isn't, or a child's converted and the parents are not. In any of these scenarios, one of the dangers for the young believer is that they feel that they have got to be able to immediately mount an answer for every question and work out every problem and respond to every thing that comes. And it isn't so. There's great power in just the earnestness of the simplicity of your experience. Great power in that. In fact, it's an irrefutable power. What can you say? What could they say to this young man? Nothing. That's a good point. Any other? Anybody have any other thing you'd like to discuss? It's a wonderful reading, this part two. I think part two is just tremendous. A treatment of so many things.